Watershed Stewardship Report. Mr. Eli Scott and Clayton Krieger.
Good afternoon, Chairman Noren and fellow board members. I am Clayton Krieger, the Watershed Stewardship Coordinator of your staff. And here with me today is Eli Scott, also of your staff. He is our Siskiyou Watershed Stewardship person. I wanted to start today a little bit first by acknowledging a few people in the room who have helped us considerably with what you're going to hear today. First and foremost is Adrian Garialdi, who was formerly the executive director of the Shasta RCD and during much of the period of time when the TMDL was developed and a lot of the implementation actions. They were the fiscal agent and the implementer for several grants, which made the projects that we're going to be talking about today possible. And last time we were here, she was actually up here at this table, and the focus then was on the project work that the RCD was doing. We're going to cover that a little bit today, but now we're going to be looking at the water quality effects of those projects. So I just wanted to acknowledge and thank Adrian for all the assistance that the RCD has provided to us. In addition, I wanted to point out Callie Grant and Nicholas Cusick. They are our Watershed Stewardship Program participants that we've had this year. We've had the fortunate having Nick for 2 years. This is his second year with us. They start generally in October and run through August, and they have been doing a considerable amount of work for us in terms of the historical ecology and the data analysis on temperature. Nick has been working on that, and Callie's been working on the historical ecology, and I just wanted to acknowledge their contributions to this presentation. So thank you, guys. Sorry to embarrass you. What we're here to do today is we've talked about adaptive management as an objective of this agency, science-based adaptive management. We have an opportunity here in Shasta with the work we've been doing to be able to accomplish that a little bit today, and that's what we'll be talking about. We're going to cover a little bit on the background of that because adaptive management is about the management activities that you've implemented. So our presentation today will provide a little bit of an overview on TMDL-related activities, a little bit of background on what we've been able to accomplish through stewardship. We'll have a stewardship report summary. And then Eli is going to hone in on the water quality status and trends, some of the data analysis that we've done. And then he's going to talk about what we're going to be doing with the report, its next steps. It's not yet final. And then what have we learned from all this? What are the TMDL adaptive management steps that we have? So the famous swirly, I just want to emphasize that TMDL implementation involves a lot, and our stewardship approach here is part of that, and it's an adaptive management cycle. And with it, it increases our opportunity for partnerships. We'll be able to demonstrate today that it's helped us leverage resources in terms of projects that we've been able to accomplish. And we hope to be able to demonstrate that we're more rigorously tracking what we're doing and the impact of that over time. So today, you've heard a lot about various different things, and then sometimes it's hard to untangle it, but all of it kind of falls under a broader general umbrella of TMDL-related activities because we're there to improve supporting conditions and to remove impairments. And a big part of that has been the implementation of the waivers that you're going to be hearing more about this afternoon later. Eli's going to cover that for you. And what this does is it kind of lays the context for why we are going to be making the recommendations that we're making in terms of the next round of those waiver approvals. We also have a grant and contracts program that sponsors a lot of projects, and so that's covered here today as well as part of our TMDL-related activities. And then we can't take nearly all the credit. There's lots of efforts out there on the part of other NGOs, non-governmental organizations, TNC, the Big Springs Ranch, the work that's been done there. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA NIMS have been working on a program called Safe Harbor, which is similar to our waiver program, but working with individual landowners to improve survival conditions for coho and chinook. And then there's the action of individual landowners that our RCD and individual landowners have initiated of their own taking. So earlier today there was a question about, can you demonstrate that this one activity had this impact? And the question is no, because there's a whole complex matrix of activities out there. And so that's why I want to go through all of this, because we need to track it all through stewardship, and we need to consider it all, because it's not just one program element or one project. It's a complex matrix of projects. The Shasta River Watershed Stewardship Report, there's a little bit of history here that's important to realize. And that is that it was started as part of a Klamath Basin Monitoring Program initiative, in which the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program has a website, and we wanted to make the most use of that website to promote communication amongst watershed groups. And so for each one of the sub-basins, we wanted to create a watershed stewardship report that would be updated on a regular basis as an adaptive management tool for all of the sub-basins within the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program. At that time, we were looking for a pilot project from which to undertake the Watershed Stewardship Report, and the Shasta RCD self-identified for that project. And so that's when they stepped forward and said, we've been doing a lot of work. We'd like to document that work. We'd like to tell the good story that we've been working on. And so that's where it started. And working with them, the initiative through the K-Bump meeting, 56 member organizations voted on this. We had a preliminary outline, but with that, they granted the flexibility for each sub-basin and each sub-basin lead, in this case the RCD, to modify that outline to meet their local conditions or local situation best. And so what the Watershed Stewardship Report will include is a description of the partnerships that we've been forming in the basin. It'll provide a watershed description and setting, because every watershed is different. I mean, Shasta is unique from Scott in terms of its hydrology and all kinds of factors that have to be taken into consideration. Its historical ecology is different, and we'll cover that a little bit of that today. The water quality issues of concern in each watershed are generally different, requiring different approaches, different tools. And there's a catalog of stewardship projects. Again, this is an adaptive management document, so we want to keep good track of the efforts that have been undertaken. And then what Eli is going to talk today, present some of today, is some of the analysis that we've done in terms of the water quality status and trends. And then, in the end, the value of it, it's a living document. We update it regularly, or the adaptive management recommendations. So I mentioned that we had quite a partnership, and so this affects the status of the Watershed Stewardship Report, is that we obtained information and had participation from many different people within the watershed, and this is a list of them here. And so each one of these organizations that either provided expertise or data will have an opportunity to review the final report by the end of July, before we post it to the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program. But part of the value of this report has been the relationships that we have strengthened through this process. I just want to draw your attention to this. There's a historical ecology is an important part of this. We have a fellow by the name of Chuck Striplin that you've encountered, who came from SFEI, their historical ecology program. You heard a little bit about it today. We're using it within the Laguna de Santa Rosa. And it's about trajectory, not necessarily pre-disturbance conditions. It's how did the watershed get to where it's at today, and what portion of that may be recoverable through reconciliation ecology. It's not going back to some point in time that's not achievable, but it's how can we retrace the steps, what part of that is recoverable. And part of knowing that is knowing all of the historical events that helped shape the watershed that you see today. And those are the events across the top of the timeline there. Those would be things like the construction of Dwinelle Dam. And it can be human things When did a water master become available? When did they really start tracking use and diversion of water in the watershed? Because that affects behavior. And so we try to document all these important aspects along the top there. We're helpful a lot by David Webb of the RCD, who's quite a historian. In addition to that, we use various background information and indicators on things like water use by tracking on the top there is irrigated acreage. And you can see an increasing trend over time. Again, it's just an estimate. It's just an indicator. It's not the absolute, but as a line of evidence, it can be very informative. We also have in the Shasta a very good record of the populations of Chinook salmon. There's good census data on that. And that next chart down shows you the population of Chinook salmon over time. And that can you from there you can see that we've gone from historically high levels in the early 20s and prior to 1920 to very much lower conditions today. And so something's going on there, and we're trying to unravel that. And the last chart there is an example of what we call a unimpaired and impaired flow analysis. Unimpaired flow is that estimate of what flow would be without any human diversions. And then the impaired flow, and that's just the terminology that's used in this analysis, that's not the term that we applied, is the comparison between the two. And you can see that there's an increasing trend over time there as well. So there's more in the report, and I encourage you to look at it. I just wanted to present this to you today to try to convey to you the importance of historical ecology and some of the thought and effort that's gone into this presentation of this document. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Eli Scott, and he is going to take you through some of the more of the information that's in the report and get into detail on the water quality analyses, unless there's any questions to this point.
Any questions? Welcome, Eli.
Thank you. So my name's Eli Scott. I'm an environmental scientist in the Adaptive Management Unit. I'm a Scott and Shasta Watershed Steward. So like Clayton said, this document is really, I think, the cornerstone of adaptive management in the Shasta River watershed. It's what tells us, you know, where we've been in the watershed, where we are right now, and where we need to go. So as an example, this is a partial list of the projects that have been completed through 319H grants, through other grants to look at improving water quality conditions, a lot of irrigation efficiency projects, a lot of plantings. It's important if we're trying to assess the effectiveness of the work that we've done that we know, you know, what we've done and where. Another important part is to assess the success of different activities. So this is an example of a couple different sites where there's been significant planting, different riparian grazing management practices, including sometimes exclusion. So up top we have Big Springs Creek, which is an area that's managed by the Nature Conservancy currently. In 2008, pretty heavily impacted riparian conditions. 2012, after fencing, after different riparian plantings, you can see there's an improvement in terms of habitat complexity, stream channel width. So, you know, there's less potential for solar radiation to heat up the water in that area. There's also been a lot of work towards increasing cold water input into that stretch. Below that is the Monongahela Bridge. Again, a lot of riparian plantings. You see 1993 conditions there with pretty heavy impacts. And then in 2011, there's some significant improvements. That's generally the same area. So, you know, there has been improvement over time from these activities that have been implemented by partners and by different grant work. The next step is, what does the data show? So we want to know, you know, is there a measurable improvement in water quality trends over time from this work? So to look at that within the report, we looked at dissolved oxygen and temperature, which are what the Shasta River's listed for on the 303D list. A little bit about the Shasta, the impacts are very much localized to different land use practices. So you can see this is a figure that was put together by both the Shasta Valley RCD and Aquaterra in some of the early work to identify different tailwater management practices. They ranked the different tailwater neighborhoods, as they call them. They're kind of hydrologically distinct units of land management that pour into the river. The red would indicate a high priority, yellow, medium, green, low. And this is based off of the potential for habitat restoration, the amount of cold water spring flow that comes into these areas. And really, it just illustrates that there's a lot of different localized impacts. And the black dots that you can see there and there are different stewardship activities, whether they're plantings or tailwater management or irrigation efficiency practices that were implemented in those areas. So to look at dissolved oxygen, I went back to the basin plan to look at what the beneficial uses that we're looking at. The most sensitive one is cold water habitat. So the level, the cutoff for impairment there would be anything below 6 milligrams per liter as a daily minimum value. So using that as sort of my threshold, you know, we looked at the time between June 22nd and September 30th. So there's a couple reasons why we chose that. One, irrigation season is in full force there. So you have a lot of the impacts in terms of nutrients and heating from the use of flood irrigation, which means tailwater flows and temperature at their highest. Respiration is also at its peak. So there's a lot of emergent vegetation that happens within the Shasta River, as well as attached algae. And during that part of the year, that's at its peak, which means respiration is peaking in midday and then, you know, crashing towards the middle of the night when there's no solar radiation to drive photosynthesis. This is also where oversummer habitat is crucial for coho salmon. So the metric used to examine sort of the level of impairment or the ability to support beneficial uses is the percentage of days in that time period where dissolved oxygen falls below 6 milligrams per liter, so below the basin plan objective. And any years that were missing 15% or more of those days, we did not consider them because it would skew the data set. So first off, current conditions. We're looking at 2015 and 2016 in this. And this is a longitudinal analysis. So up at this end, you're more towards Dwinell Dam, or Dwinell. So upstream. And then this would be the mouth of the Shasta River when it flows into the Klamath. So what you can see up towards Dwinell, a good majority of the days are below the basin plan objective, which is more impaired. Towards the midstream by the Monte Granada Bridge, there's a lower level of impairment. And actually, in 2016, none of the days in these three dissolved oxygen monitors were actually below 6 milligrams per liter, which is, you know, says something good. This right here is the site of the former Arujo Dam. It still has some issues that we need to address. So again, this just illustrates the amount of localized impacts and how they play a role in this throughout the whole stretch of the Shasta River. But then we want to know long-term trends, right? We want to know what's happened over time. So I forgot to remind everyone, the Shasta River flows from south to north. So this is upstream, and that's Klamath River right there. So I picked three dissolved oxygen monitors that have significant long-term data, usually starting in 2018 and going to 2016. So that's Nelson Ranch, which is right downstream of the high-priority area. So that's one location. The Monte Granada Bridge, which is in a lower priority area, but we've seen a lot of stewardship activities there, all the black dots. And then the Arujo Dam site, where there was a impoundment that has been removed, but it also incurs some influence from some medium priority areas. So looking at the Nelson Ranch, you can see there's not really much of a trend here. Again, this shows percentage of days where dissolved oxygen drops below 6 milligrams per liter. So there's not really a noticeable trend there. Not really, I don't really want to say why, but this doesn't get a lot of influence from water coming out of Dwinell, as well as the high priority areas where, you know, while we've had stewardship activities, they're not really local to that location. And my feeling is they're likely not commensurate in scale to the level of impact that's experienced there. The Monte Granada Bridge, we actually do see some very promising results. So again, there's been a lot of stewardship activities here, driven by grant funds and done by partners. And it's a lower priority, medium priority area. So the impact isn't as big. So what I think this shows is where you have that effort put in by landowners, by partner organizations, to the level of impact that these areas are experiencing, you do see some improvement. And then finally, the Arujo Dam site, where you don't have much in terms of stewardship activities having occurred there, there really is no trend. They're still impaired fairly significantly. And, you know, it shows that there likely needs to be more effort in that area. And it also speaks to the locality of these impacts. For temperature, we looked at Big Springs Creek, as well as the Shasta River at on the main stem. And at Big Springs Creek, there is a significant trend downward. So this has been tested. It is statistically significant. And again, this is an area where there's been riparian plantings, where there's been managed grazing, and there's also been a lot of work to increase cold water flows into this area. In the main stem, we actually see an increasing trend. So that one verifies that something's working in Big Springs. It also shows that there's more work that's needed throughout the river. So some of the next steps for the stewardship report, we want to complete our internal and partner review, submit this report to the Klamath Tracking and Accounting Program, present to stakeholder groups so they can see what the findings are, post the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program, Watershed Stewardship page, and then, of course, we want to manage adaptively, which means continued implementation of the waivers, continued support of stewardship projects like spring rehabilitation, tailwater reduction, riparian planting strategies. We want to support model development to assess flow and temperature restoration scenarios, and then support and participate in the California Water Action Plan, because that is currently going on in the Shasta River. So.
Thank you, Eli. And it's just as part as that, one of the things that we're learning is that stewardship activities, and when we use the term stewardship activities, they may be related to the waivers, practices that may have been encouraged through waiver review. It may have been through a grant program. It may have been self-initiated. It's just a general term that we use and that the RCD also uses. So we've adopted that. So we consider them all to be TMDL-related activities because they're working towards supporting conditions. But one of the things that we think we're seeing, and that last bullet that Eli mentioned about working with the California Water Action Plan, is that we suspect that through stewardship activities, we will not achieve our objectives alone. That the TMDL originally called for 45 CFS of cold water in addition to these practices. And we believe we don't know the amount, and that's why we highlighted the need for an improved temperature and flow model, and we're working very closely with other organizations that are interested in developing that. In fact, Nick has been helping us lay out the foundation for that model. We suspect that more work on flow is going to have to accompany what we've been doing in terms of these restoration and stewardship activities like riparian protection strategies and such and tailwater return flows. So there is a lot of good work being done already. We're reconnecting springs. There's one spring project.
Hidden Valley.
Hidden Valley, where we're seeing 6 to 13 CFS of cold water that will be coming into the river. But we also need to ensure that that water, as been pointed out in an earlier presentation, that it is somewhat protected in terms of being environmental water. So there's a lot of work left to be done, but we think we've made some pretty good, reasonable progress, and we're hopeful for the future. And with that, we'll take any questions or comments.
First question I would have is, so you have a report, you talked about a report, but you didn't put a date when it was gonna be out.
I was supposed to add that. So I believe it'll be towards the end of July. We'll be ready to send it around. And
he was supposed to add that, but let me add that I've been working on it for the last 2 years, and it should have been done before now, and he shouldn't have had to do that. So,
That's okay. Well, by the way, I know this is your first time in front of us, Eli. Mm-hmm. First time you've come in front of us publicly. I'm very encouraged to have you be a part of that stewardship up there and working with Clayton and some of the other partners up there. That's fantastic. And just look forward to the report. I just would ask, what's the pathway to get that report out in dissemination? Who's that report for generally, and what's your intent of how that report then resonates or is used to inform future actions and items?
Well, I'll just be really honest here that the RCD was the lead on the report, but there are some elements that we had to do in terms of the data analysis and such, and it does include a section on flow. And it's possible their board has been very reluctant. Their staff has been hugely supportive. Their board is somewhat reluctant participants. And when they see the final, we may lose them as a sponsor. We hope not. A lot of the work in there is work that they've done. But we have other partners that contribute. A lot of this. I want to mention that there is a monitoring plan that is a part of this report. 2 years of this effort were spent just collecting data that was held by individuals on their own computers. And we had to do a couple years of tracking down where they had put who else had put monitoring locations there, doing the quality assurance, compiling it into a single database, running that database by everybody, and making sure that we had a consistent, coherent database. Now, everybody who contributed to that wants an opportunity to review these results. And so these are preliminary results. We've been working with them quite closely. We don't expect any surprises, but we want their stamp of approval on it before we put it up on the website. And so we think that'll take about a month, given the level of communication that we've had all along with them.
And let me ask again, so you think end of July that report comes out? That's a report that's basically self-published on our website, Clayton. Is that report to fulfill obligations to other agencies, grants, anything?
I think what we'll do is have a link on our website to the KBUMP website, because that fulfills the KBUMP pilot project. And Randy Turner will, our KBUMP coordinator, is looking into different program options for how we'll load it up. But it will also be available in a PDF format as well, and we'll be able to be downloaded from the website. So, yeah.
I think reports like this and assessment of data and progress is just super important. I think there's, you know, we go blindly forth with a TMDL with the greatest of plans, and I think it's really important to look in the rearview mirror once in a while to see what worked and what didn't work, what needs to be amended and changed. And I think, you know, even if it's distasteful, that data tells a story, or if it's disappointing, even that data tells a story about progress or lack thereof.
Well, now that we have a coherent monitoring plan in place that was bought in by every one of those organizations, we'll all be reporting our data to the same place. Our next step, and it's something that Shinrei has been really leading us on through SFEI, is finding tools like CD3 and EcoAtlas that take us beyond just a published report, but allow people to do the mashup themselves of the data at the website. Ultimately, that is the goal of the Klamath Basin Monitoring Program website, is not just to have a static report,
right,
but to actually offer the opportunity for people to use data visualization tools to look at the data themselves and to come to their own conclusions.
Mr. John.
Yeah, I wanted to, well, first of all, I hope when you're leaving with your promotion, you're not introducing the next person dealing with these problems. But welcome on board. I did want to stress Clayton's comment of that when you don't use water for irrigation, that there's some protection for environmental use, because all it takes is one water right holder downstream or upstream who makes a call on water they haven't had for years, and suddenly it disappears. And I think people are willing to help this community find a solution, but I don't want to help develop a water right that's not really usable now, and then have us right back in the same spot. And I know it's quite tricky, and there were certain delays and challenges with the state board who people were, if they changed their diversion, the state board staff were, instead of looking that they're trying to devote it for environmental purposes, was looking more on enforcement, and I think we got past that. But we really need to focus on that, because a lot of time and money's going into this, and it's going into nothing unless we can assure that.
Well,
and I'm not saying it's an easy problem. I know it's very complex, but
it's one of our lessons learned. We saved quite a bit of water through the tailwater return flow projects, and there are definitely some benefits from those projects, but we could have enhanced those benefits if we had been more aware and had been more proactive about including a 1707 process as part of those projects. And so towards that end, we partially funded a project with the Nature Conservancy for them to explore different ways of how organizations and entities can use 1707, because it's really not a well-known or well-understood.
Right. And I think the state tool. Board's now geared up. They were sort of almost, you'd think they'd be hyper-experienced on it and the mimeograph machine to get it out, but they had challenges too. But I want to say the whole, everything depends on that.
Right.
Because there, and who knows what's,
Well, I just also want to point out,
but
too,
they had rumors that people were approaching the senior right holders to make sure they got in their claims the second the water got due. Well, maybe totally false, and that's entirely, but it did raise the issue that if you don't preserve the water right, then someone else can use it.
Yeah, I just want to qualify that, though, a little bit. I should have been a little more careful. Yeah. When you use a 1707, you don't get the whole amount that you've conserved. There's a consumptive part of that that's eligible for protection. It's not the entire amount, so... it's a limited tool. It's not the only tool. We're going to have to keep using a lot of other tools, but it's one that we're learning better how to use.
And I think you stated the general rule, and I'll give you a slight exception that's favorable out of the meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
Comments or questions?
What's a mimeograph?
What's a mimeograph?
That's a Johnism.
Thank you.
Well, listen, thank you very much, gentlemen. I don't have any speaker cards on this, so I think this is information only at this point. You know, Eli, I'm very interested always in looking in the rearview mirror and in the front view mirror, and I think it's important to do both. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily at the same time, but, you know, to know where we've been to inform where we need to go and what happened here. There was things that did not happen in these watersheds, and we're all pretty well aware of that. The interest now is how do we go forward with intent and good purpose, given what we know now and what we need to know in the future to reach TMDL goals, to reach the other goals that are out here. Because the other thing is these watersheds, when I say these, both Scott and the Shasta, they're complicated watersheds. They have multiple agencies doing multiple things out here, including ourselves. So stewardship's the name of the game on that front, to just link that stuff together and to try to make it so it's coherent. But I thank you very much for coming today.